nice to be here. It's the first time I visit Perimeter, so thanks a lot for organizing this. This is some work we've been doing. It took a while to write this up, so this has been going on for a while now with Johannes and then Toby Cubitt and David. And you can find it on the archive. It was we posted it like only a few weeks ago. And I don't usually like too much to make too many jokes, but this came up today on Saturday morning breakfast cereal, so I could not resist mentioning it. So we are talking about problems which are like not solvable and why it's good. So anyway, the spectral gap problem, right? I want to start being very kind of explicit of what exactly we're talking about. So the problem is a decision problem. So we consider a spin chain of n qubits, and we have open boundary conditions, qubits. And then we have this two local translation invariant Hamiltonian. So in order to specify one object of this type, you have to basically give two things. The single site interaction terms, which is like just a D by D Hermitian matrix, and then the nearest neighbor interaction term, which is just a D squared times D squared Hermitian matrix. And once you specify these two objects, which I want to stress were a kind of a finite thing to describe, for each choice of your length of this chain, you can define an Hamiltonian just by translation invariant. So this is the Hamiltonian you define for each n once you're given these two input. And now the problem we ask is, if I give you a description of this H1 and H2, can you tell me if the family of Hamiltonian you define on the spin chain is a gapped or a gapless family? And what I mean by gapped or gapless, we want to make this very kind of unambiguous. So somehow we promise that the interaction only define Hamiltonian for which only one of these two things can happen. So there are no like intermediate cases. So for gapped system, I really mean you have a unique ground state and there is an energy gap and every other state sits on top of that energy level for n. And for the gapless case, I really mean that you have like an interval on top of a ground state energy, which is becoming denser and denser of like eigenvalues. So it's, we want to avoid a situation where you have an excited state who collapses on the ground state, but then another gap opens on top of it. So this is not going to happen. We promise you this is not going to happen, and you have to decide which one is true.
Is it important that they open boundary conditions?
It will be important for our construction. So you might ask this question for periodic boundary condition. It's a very interesting problem. Our construction will not work in that case. We'll comment it at the end of the talk, but basically for us it's very important. So the problem might be decidable for open periodic boundary conditions as far as my construction works.
How about the degeneracy of ground state?
So for gap, we restrict to single non-degenerate ground state. So somehow it should be easier to distinguish this, right? Because you don't have these ambiguities of how you can consider like degenerate ground state. So we're just avoiding these cases somehow. By construction, we avoid. And so now you should keep in mind, this is not about complexity. This is not how much, it's not about how much time it takes. It's just whether there is an algorithm which will eventually terminate and give you an answer. So you want to show that somehow if you try to solve this problem, you might get up doing a computation which you cannot guarantee it's going to terminate. It's not a matter of polynomial versus exponential time. It's just a matter of you can actually compute this or not. And so in 1D, for these open spin chains, it's if you restrict yourself to qubits, so the so smallest somehow local dimension possible, and if you consider frustration-free Hamiltonians, then the problem is actually easy. So this was shown in 2015. It was classified by Bravi and Gossett. You take your local interaction term, you massage it into a Chuba-Chu matrix, you compute the eigenvalues. If they are equal, you say yes. It's a simple thing. But if you ask this problem on the 2D squared lattice, where you also have like vertical and horizontal interaction, then you, as you probably know, it was shown a few years ago by subset of my the co-authors plus Michael Wolff that this is undecidable. And how they show this, they basically map the problem to deciding whether a Turing machine with a given input will halt or not, which is the undecidable problem. So there's no algorithm which can give you the answer. So because we have some of these two extremes, if you go one dimension higher, it's undecidable. If you restrict to very small local dimension, it becomes decidable. We wanted to kind of see what is the status for a 1D construct. And the reason is that some of the construction for the undecidability in the 2D square lattice does not work in 1D. And I will comment later why it doesn't work. So we had to modify it to make this thing work. So some of the question was open until a few weeks ago. Why would you think this problem should be different in 1D as compared to higher dimensions? Somehow, spin chain in 1D seems to be more easy to work with. So this is very heuristic. I'm not trying to claim anything here, but just to comment that a lot of the exactly solvable models we know are in 1D, so we can work very easily with a lot of 1D models. For the ones which you can really solve exactly, you have DMRG, which is very good. It works very well in practice, and it gives you extremely interesting answers. If you know you have a gap, then we actually have algorithms which have proofs, which will be polynomial in computing the ground state properties. And we have this area law for the ground states and the matrix product states representation. So we have a lot of like kind of numerical tools to and theoretical tools to study these systems. And there are no thermal phase transition from this model. So if you have temperature, there are no critical points at all. You will not have topological order. So a lot of strange quantum feature in 1D do not show up. On the other hand, some questions are indeed hard. So if you want to, the local Hamiltonian problem, which is I give you a local Hamiltonian, you have to tell me if a ground state energy is above or below some thresholds with inverse polynomial precision, it's QMA hard. So it's like hard even for a quantum computer. So this is what kind of the situation was. And so this is what we do. I will flesh out the result and then trying to go through the proof and give some idea. But just for concreteness, we do this construction by fixing one universal Turing machine, which will be some of the source of instability in our construction. And when we create this a few matrices, and this point 1, 2, and 3, I'm just trying to argue that this can be defined with a finite number of bits. So these matrices either have entries in Z and they're diagonal, or they have entries in some rational field, which is easy to specify. And these are independent of your input of a Turing machine. So this is we specify one once for all. And then for each input n and each rational number beta, which again is rational, so you can specify, we construct these interaction terms. So these are just one, doesn't matter too much the shape of it, but just to show how the input comes in as a phase in these things and so as some weight. And this phi is the binary fraction defined by the input n, but where we have interleaved some numbers once in this binary expansion. And we explain later why we need this. But somehow this should be, again, specified by polynomial number of bits in n, which is important. And then this interaction will give rise to families of Hamiltonian whose behavior depends on what this universal Turing machine does on your input n. So if the machine halts or loops around given an input n, this will be a gapless system. If it doesn't halt and it will diverge, no halting, no looping, then it will be gapped and it will have a spectral gap of one. So it will be this fit in somehow in these two categories. And it will be a uni ground state. I didn't write it, but that's what I mean. And again, basically, this is what we do, because now if you want to decide whether this family is gapless or gapless, you have to basically solve the halting problem, and we know this is not doable by an algorithm. The role of beta is not really relevant, except from showing that this can be seen as a very small perturbation of a classical Hamiltonian. So beta was multiplying all the non-diagonal terms. So somehow, you need a bit of quantum mess to do this, but you don't need much of it. So you can have very small perturbation of classical Hamiltonians, which already are undecidables. So this is the only, and it's not, sorry, beta is not the temperature or anything, it's just parameters. This is so how do we construct this? It's not an easy construction, but also because we're reusing a lot of things people have done in the past. This is not the number of slides, this is the number of pages of the paper, so don't worry. Yeah?
So just to get a better
right.
idea, you say it's D times D matrices.
Right. Yeah.
Is there a simple, what's the simplest, as small as D that this can be done?
I don't know. So it's this construction will probably give you a huge D. The only relevant point is that it doesn't depend on n, right? It's just fixed. So you're not changing the local dimension depending on what input you have. But that would be kind of a bit cheating if you allow it for like diverging one. But it might be 10 million. I don't know. I really.
It's not a constructive proof. You don't have.
It depends on what type of constructive thing. It is a constructive proof. It's just I'm not sure about the number, and it's not easy to optimize it.
You don't have examples.
It's constructive in the sense there is a description of a construction.
I'm saying that you don't have examples of a prime.
No, I don't have it off the top of my head. And it's an interesting question now to see what happens between that number and two, right? This is my and the main upper question now is, if you restrict D to be 15, can you still do this?
But do you have any bounds on this D that you need, or?
Not even.
You think you could compute them, or?
Yeah. I think, it's just that somehow a lot of these Turing machine things, you can optimize a lot. And optimize, it takes a bit of tricks, and we're not interested in optimizing it, so. So these are the ingredients of these constructions. Some of these we reuse from the 2D construction. Some of these are new. The kind of main thing, like one of the main things is this the history state construction, which you probably know. It goes back to Feynman and Kitaev. But we use the Kosman-Irani version, which is for quantum Turing machines. Then we use one Turing quantum Turing machine, which is doing this quantum phase estimation algorithm. We have one classical Hamiltonian, which is selecting tape segments across this spin chain. And then we have somehow two kind of test cases. One Hamiltonian, which we call trivial, which will be the gapped example in some sense. So it will be unique ground state and gap. And some dense spectrum, like gapless Hamiltonian. And this will be our two kind of test cases. And the idea, like kind of very general overview, is this input parameter was encoded in this phase in the interaction terms. So the quantum phase estimation will read this phase, extract n from it, feed it as an input to the universal Turing machine, and then, depending on whether the machine will halt or diverge, we'll have some energy switch, which will kind of switch the low energy spectrum between the trivial and the dense Hamiltonian. And all of this has to be done in the history state of some quantum Turing machine. This is the kind of general overview. Just to give you a picture, what I mean is like somehow we have this H trivial, which has this kind of discrete spectrum, and the dense one, which is getting denser. And we want somehow kind of switch between these two situations. In one, you have the gap and the dense spectrum starts like above it, so it will not show up in the low energy sector. And in the other case, this dense thing will just be pushed down and it will flood the trivial Hamiltonian, and you will just not realize there was a gap before. So let me start going through a bit all these things and see. So history states are states of this form. You have like the superposition over a clock register and like a quantum register, and this quantum register is like contains the the list of states of a computation. So at time zero, you start from phi zero. At time one, you have this U, one applied to phi zero, and so on and so on. And this was, I guess, originally proposed by Feynman, and then there was the idea of realizing this as ground states of some Hamiltonian. And so one easy way somehow to do it here, like still a lot of details are missing, but what you want to do is just write some projector which will be minimized if you have exactly the right superposition of state. But you can see that this is exactly doing the job. If you have that state, this will exactly annihilate things which are evolving the right way. So this is, if you've never seen one, this is an example. This is the circuit creating a Jesus state. You start at time zero with a product state, and then you apply Hadamard, and then C naught, C naught, and this would be the propagation of Hamiltonian. So you try to write this down, you see that it will, these are the rules of the computation. And now this clock register has to be made in a true local Hamiltonian, but this has been done already in the past. So I will come back on this, but somehow this has to be kind of split up on a spin chain. Because we want to use this history state for quantum Turing machine, not for circuits. So quantum Turing machine is the quantum version of a Turing machine. So let me start from the non-quantum version. So this is also kind of standard. You have this Turing machine which has an alphabet, which is finite set, where you have a special blank symbol. You have a finite set of states, and one of them is the initial state, and one of them is the final state. And then you have this transition function, which is some of the program of the Turing machine. So the Turing machine, what it does, it starts on an infinite tape, which is usually initialized to some blank state. And then it will read one symbol from the tape, check what state its internal state is, and then it will transition to a new state, write a new symbol on the tape, and then move left or right. And then it will repeat, until it gets to the final state, at which point we say it's halting. So this is how a Turing machine works. A quantum Turing machine is essentially the same thing where you allow superpositions. So instead of just transitioning to a definite state and writing a definite symbol, you can go into a superposition of possible histories. And then when you next step, you keep applying this delta function somehow coherently between the different branches. And so you can think of defining this history state for the history of a quantum Turing machine. And now the history of a quantum Turing machine is the sequence of tapes at each time slice, plus the position of the head of the tape and the internal state. So somehow we have this list of information you have to write. And the nice thing about this quantum Turing machine compared to circuits, that the transition function is translation invariant. It will not change in time. So at each time step, you have to do the same thing. So the unitary that will be defined by this doesn't change with time compared to what happens in a circuit when you specify which gate to apply at each time slice. So because we want a translation invariant Hamiltonian, we wanted to restrict to this type of computational model. But you see, this is equivalent to a circuit somehow, it's just a different way. And so building on like a lot of interesting previous work, in the 2D construction, they built a true local Hamiltonian actually in 1D. So even in the 2D construction, we did this in 1D, which takes a quantum Turing machine and gives you this Hamiltonian, where the ground state is the history state of this Turing machine, is frustration-free, so has ground state energy zero and everything is, all of these are projectors. The local dimension you need to encode this history state is just depending on the symbol size and the number of sets. And what happens with the length of a spin chain? So if the spin chain is too long, in the sense the Turing machine halts before it has exhausted all the possible tape, it will just kind of do nothing until the end of the tape. So some of the history state will be preserved. And if you run out of tape before the computation has halted, it will just truncate, and it will just stop evolving at that point. So it kind of behaves nicely with respect to how much tape it has. It does what you expect it to do. But it's not an easy construction. So it takes like basically one third of a disability paper in 2D is dedicated to proving this theorem. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to talk about this because it's a whole different. So the idea is that we can use it to do what to do the phase estimation algorithm, which is, you know, reference is Nielsen Chang. It's a very standard textbook thing. What it does is it takes one it reads out a phase out of a unitary metric. So in this case, our phase will be this interleaved n1, 1, n2, 1, and so on and so on. And so this quantum Turing machine will execute the phase estimation algorithm, write out this n on the tape of a classical Turing machine, and then start a simulation of a classical Turing machine. So at some point, it will switch its behavior from a quantum Turing machine to a classical Turing machine. And now, the reason why we do this interleaving of ones is that if the phase estimation algorithm has enough tape, it will compute this number exactly and write it out with probability one. But if you don't have enough tape, you will be in some superposition of states, and this might mess up your classical Turing machine. And then the classical Turing machine might halt for different reason than because it's not reading the right input. So it will be some noise going on. So what we do, we basically check whether we have terminated reading or not the number by checking these one marks are like there to indicate that you still haven't finished reading the number. So you can check what happened. And in that case, it's not obvious, but somehow the quantum phase estimation has two steps. You apply these gates, and then you do a quantum Fourier transform. And before the quantum Fourier transform, you have the time to kind of realize you don't have enough space to complete the computation and just stop and just penalize it. So somehow we can make sure we have enough tape to do the quantum phase estimation. And so most of the stuff I was showing you at the beginning comes from these things. So this is the terms you get by constructing this quantum Turing machine history state Hamiltonian for the system. And then the idea is that somehow now we have the history state and this history Hamiltonian, what we can do, we can kind of try to see what happens to the head of this computation. So if the head goes to a halting state, we can detect it locally because it will be some special state in the local Hilbert space. Or we can check whether it's kind of hitting some tape boundary. Tape boundaries will also be a special marker, so we can do some true body check and control this. And so somehow we can penalize things just by checking locally what is going on in the Turing machine. And this is like the idea, but the problem is that the gap of this propagation Hamiltonian is small in the number of steps. So the original construction has a gap which goes by number of steps to the power of minus 3. Recent work this year has kind of improved a bit by modifying the construction, but it's still not really changing too much as far as we are concerned. It's still going to zero. And then there was a paper last week which where we claimed that you can actually do better than 1 over t, so it cannot be constant. So somehow we are stuck to some energy penalty which is vanishing in the length of the tape. And so the problem is that you cannot predict how long it will take, because that's as much undecidable as predicting whether it will halt. So this is the situation we are stuck with. So now imagine this is the length of the tape, and this is the energy penalty we can impose. So if you are halting, at some point the machine will halt, and so the penalty will drop to zero. But if it's not halting, the machine will keep running and running, and then when the chain gets longer and longer, this penalty will vanish. So for very long chains, we're not really distinguishing anything. In the limit, both of these things will be zero. So we're not really good at, so this is not enough to get a separation between the two. And this bar here is just what I was telling you about the short segment. So we need to penalize a bit and get rid of them. This is the effect is shown here. So the idea to get out of this is somehow to spawn multiple instances of a computation. Instead of just doing it once, do it many times. So this is how they did it in 2D. So in 2D, they use this quasi-periodic lat tiling, which is called Robinson tiling, which creates some structure like this, where you have all these squares, and you have larger squares, and somehow the density of squares of a given size is constant in the volume. So you always can find enough, large enough squares. And then they run one copy of this quantum Turing machine on each of these lower lines. And then they do the opposite of what we will do now, but in 1D, but so just it's kind of opposite order of construction. So if a quantum machine never terminates, there will be no penalty. So this is, these green lines means no penalty. But if at some point it will terminate, you can detect locally the halting state, so you can put this penalty, which, as I said, will be very small in the length of the tape, but will be some penalty. This is shown here. This machine had enough space to terminate. But then if you zoom out, because of this kind of fractal structure, once you terminate, any larger tape segment will also allow you to terminate. And then you realize that if you go out and out, you have quite a lot of instances where this will be terminating. So you actually get a finite density for each volume of terminate. Like terminating machine. So even if each one of them gets a very small penalty, they add up to something which is diverging to minus infinity, actually. So this is what they do in 2D. They basically get a small penalty for each copy of the instance, but they have enough of them to push the spectrum down in that case. And they do it in the opposite way. So this would be the gap situation, which would be a gapless. Sorry, the halting, the no-halting. The problem with doing this in 1D, which is the problem we were like facing, is that there are no quasi-periodic tilings in 1D. You realize that there is not enough space to do this in 1D, to get a finite density of every length feature, all the lengths. If you try to do tilings in 1D, they are periodic or very impossible. There's no quasi-periodic. It's a very different situation. So what we try to do is instead is construct this, what we call this Mark Hamiltonian. The Mark Hamiltonian will cut out segments of the spin chain to be tape segments. And then on each one of these tape segments, we run one copy of a Turing machine, just like before. So we can have this situation when, you know, I have this tape segment, I have a longer one, and then I have a shorter one. And then we do the opposite to what we're doing in 2D. So if the machine halts or loops, it will not get a penalty. But if it runs out of tape and it hits this boundary at the other extreme, we will give a penalty to that. And now what is the idea? It's we want to construct this marker Hamiltonian in such a way that shorter segments are energetically more favorable than longer segments. So the Mark Hamiltonian will try to squeeze the segments into smaller pieces. But the penalty you get from running out of tape is large enough that it would be still better to extend the segment. So somehow, as long as the machine is not halting, it will have enough energy to push the marker outside. But when it halts, there will be no benefit in getting this longer tape. So this marker will be squeezed down to this size, which is the minimal size you need to do the computation. So this is what will happen. If a machine doesn't halt, it doesn't matter how long the tape it is, it will always run out of tape. And we always pick up this penalty, which, as we said, it's small in the number of steps. The energy bonus that you get from having multiple segments will not compensate for this penalty because it will be smaller. And so the best thing to do is just have one long tape and get only one penalty. And then this penalty will tend to zero in the limit. So in this way, you will get a zero energy ground state. But if a tape halts, then at some point, you will not get the penalty anymore. And so the best thing to do is to have many copies of that machine running in parallel. And what's the optimal length? Well, you want to minimize it because somehow smaller segments are better, but leaving enough space for a machine to halt. So somehow this will select the optimal size, and each of these segments will get a a constant negative energy, which will sum up and go to minus infinity. So this is some of the picture on how this works. This was the penalty from a computation before. Sorry, the dotted line is the penalty from a computation. This is the bonus you get from a tab segment length. And this red line is the sum of the two. So your machine doesn't halt. Well, you get a slightly less penalty, but in the end, you still go to zero. If the machine at some point halts, you are tending to zero from above, but then you suddenly jump below, and then you tend to zero from below. So the minimal energy here is actually this point, is not in the infinity. So the best thing is to cut out many tapes of that sweet spot length and copy it over and over.
Okay, so this is just about the ground state. This is not yet about the gap.
Right, this is just about the ground state. So this will be used then to do this energy switch between the trivial and the dense. I'm just trying to construct a ground state energy which depends on the computation.
But in the limit, it's still zero.
Not in this case, right? Because in this case, it will be better to have many segments of this length. Each one of them will get a small negative energy. And so you will have constant negative density, and the ground state energy will go to zero, minus infinity.
Sorry, the picture doesn't make that clear.
No, sorry. This is somehow the penalty for a single tape segment. And now the question is, how do you want to split your long chain into different segments to minimize the energy? So in this case, the best thing to do is one long segment. In this case, the best thing to do is many segments of the right size. Is it clear? So, but somehow this, as I say, this bonus you get from the tape has to be smaller. Otherwise, this construction will not work. So we have to somehow find a way of giving these markers a decaying attractive interaction, which has to be faster than this polynomial thing. And this is what I will talk about for basically the rest. This is the new, very new part of it. So the idea is you have this special state, this black box, which is marking the beginning and the end of a tape segment. And if you were allowed to do exponential decaying interaction, then it would be easy to do what I just said. You just have an attractive interaction between these two markers, which decays with space. So somehow, longer they are, the weaker the attraction. And now the problem is how to make this true local, because we wanted to prove something for true local Hamiltonian, not for exponential decay. So here we are somehow trying to simulate an exponential decay interaction with a finite range interaction. And the idea is very similar to the clock idea, is to use a counter. So we use three symbols, the black square, the white triangle, and the black triangle. And black squares separate tape segments. And inside the tape segment, we have this counter, which starts with all white triangles. And then you add one black, and then one other black, and then it goes on. And you take the superposition of things. So we want to create states which they have this kind of signature, which tells you where the black markers are. And in between these markers, you have this superposition of state. And then it's kind of product between one and the other. And so we will also not really use this unitary counter, but this is just to explain the construction, how it works. So this, again, can be done very easily by defining interaction of this form. So this is responsible for propagating one black triangle to the right. And this is responsible of stopping when you find a marker at the end of a chain. And then you initialize by saying, oh, I give a penalty if the black triangle is not left to the square. This cannot happen because it goes in the other direction. And also, let's avoid segments with like zero length. So it's a bit. And so this is tree local because this construction is tree local. So I will actually do this with tree local terms, and then there is a way of making this true local, which I will not show, but somehow it's similar ideas to this. And we also want to avoid segments which do not terminate. So we want somehow enforce the chain starts and ends with a square. And again, there is this boundary trick, which we can use just because somehow the number of edges is different from the number of vertices in such spin system. We can enforce the chain to start with a square. But this lowers the energy to -4, well, before we're at 0. So this is basically enforcing a boundary condition with translation invariant interaction. And now the Hamiltonian we construct is somehow block diagonal in the blocks where you have a well-defined signature. So for each choice of where to put the markers, you will see that this Hamiltonian will not change states with that markers to states with different markers. So the Hamiltonian cannot move the black squares in some sense. They are fixed by their signature. And on each of them, it acts kind of like a graph Laplacian, because it's just really of a path graph, so really giving you a transition from the first element of the graph to the second, then to the last. And now, how to implement this exponential decay of exponential decay attraction? Well, what we can do is we can take the last state in this superposition of segments and give a penalty to it and compensate a bit to have the right scaling of things. And so what this effect does is to take this graph Laplacian and get rid of the last entry on it. So this is a graph Laplacian of a line of 5 sides. This is telling you, you know, you can go from the first to the second, from the second to the third, and this is different because you cannot go left from the first, you're going to go right from the last. And then this penalty is basically getting rid of this entry setting. And now it's a bit of computation, but you can compute the spectrum of this object quite well, easily, like a couple of pages, but it's elementary calculation. And it has all of the eigenvalue are positive, except from one which is negative, and it lies around -1/2 in a range of it lies a little bit of a left and 1/2, which depends on the length of the segment. So this is the tricky part. This is where you get this exponential decaying of energy. So when you reshift and you look at one block of this Hamiltonian where you have all these segments marked, and each of these blocks will have this minimal eigenvalue, which is between 2 to the minus the length this one should be a 4. Otherwise, this doesn't make sense. Somehow, you get a small exponential penalty for each of these segments, and you sum up on all the segments you have. And the next eigenvalue is 1/2 above, because of this gap you have here. It's only one minimal eigenvalue. And now, instead of using a unitary counter, you do some more stuff. So unitary counter already requires local dimension 3. But if you grow up the local dimension, you can do a binary counter, you can do a base 5 counter, you can do more complicated things. And there are these ways of making these counters through locals. And so somehow you can give a penalty which is exponential in the number of, so the maximal number you can count to, essentially. Right. Here we could count up to W, so we got a W penalty. But if you can count up to larger number, you can get a larger penalty. And here also, sorry, this should be a 4. So you do similar construction, you get kind of better decay rates of this. This really goes very fast, but you still get this kind of attractiveness of the. So this is how we do the switch. This is how we compose all these things I was talking about together in one. So we take this propagation Hamiltonian, the penalty for running out of tape, and the marker which selects the tape segment and makes them attractive. And I will bundle it all together in like quantum Turing machine plus tape segment. And now the ground state energy of this Hamiltonian, it will be slightly positive at tending to 0 as the length of a chain increases if the universal Turing machine we have used doesn't halt on input n. while it will be diverging to minus infinity in case it halts, because it will accumulate negative energy for each of its tape segments. And now we do this thing of kind of using this difference to create some kind of switch between the trivial and the dense Hamiltonian. So we take one trivial Hamiltonian with finite but negative ground state energy, and one dense Hamiltonian with continuous spectrum, like the XY chain on a spin 1/2. And then we combine them in this way. It's very kind of easy to see what happens. So this switch is, and so we basically put these things in different sectors of the local Hilbert spaces, and this switch is making sure that you don't get mixtures between one sector and the other. So it's penalizing things which live in different sectors, so that the ground state has to be either a ground state of this or a ground state of that. And now, if this quantum Turing machine Hamiltonian has a minus infinity as a ground state, it will kind of overcome the dense spectrum, and you will get. It will come associated with dense spectrum, so you will get the dense spectrum if the machine halts. If it doesn't halt, this thing has ground state zero. This thing has ground state zero. This thing has ground state energy minus one. It will win, and you will see the gap below it. And so we get this kind of switch between the halting and non-halting case. It gets mapped to a dense and trivial switch. So let me just summarize the construction. We have this quantum Turing machine, a history Hamiltonian, and we run many copies of it according to this marker. And the marker are attractive in such a way that you can kind of switch between a ground state zero, ground state energy zero, ground state energy minus infinity, depending on whether you halt or not. And this allows to construct a switch. So this goes in the opposite direction as the 2D construction. The 2D construction was, if you halt, you will be gapless. The 2D will be opposite. If you halt, you will be gapped, and if you're not halting, you'll be gapless. In this case, it's the opposite. So it's nicer because somehow if you start doing finite size analysis, so you try to say, okay, let's put this in one of these algorithms, which will tell me if what is the ground state energy and what the ground state looks like. For short segment, it will tell you it's gapped. It looks like a product state. But you don't know if this is happening because the machine will never halt or because you haven't given it enough space to hold. So, and you can't predict what the size is. So at some point, this thing will, you know, will be trivial until you add enough space for a machine to do the computation, and it will become gapless. Somehow you start from a trivial looking state, but it will be gapless in at a system size which is undecidably large. So you can't really predict. So there is no contradiction with the fact you can compute this very quickly, very easily for small segments, just that it will not tell you anything about the long-term behavior of these things. As we were discussing at the beginning, there is local dimension is completely not physical, like this. You know, I'm not claiming this can be really made into a material like it is. But it might be interesting to see what how much can you reduce and where you can get. Can you still get understability for smaller system type? For 2D, we constructed some funny models where they are not undecidable, but some of the properties they have change at some very large system size using very small local dimension, like 8 to 10. So we don't know how much one can get in 1D, but maybe you can do something similar. And we don't really have a good way to handle periodic boundary condition in some sense, because we need to have a way to initialize the tape on one side. And so we can do these things on periodic boundary condition, but if you restrict to things which are like coprime with some number, so that somehow you still have a way of kind of breaking this periodicity in some sense, but not for any finite chain length. So this is kind of a bit strange, and that's basically what I wanted to say. Thank you.
So, so for the 2D classical case,
mm-hmm.
there's, depending on, you know, which combination of things you look at, there's this case with open boundary conditions, translation invariant, but not in any rotation
right.
Sense, which is easy, but the algorithm just depends on some undecidable quantity, which is that if you can tile the whole plane, then you can make any size
mm-hmm.
without an energy penalty. But if you can't, then there's some maximum size that you can do. So there's, you know, some size where the energy equals zero, and then it jumps up to some thing. So this has the property that there's an easy algorithm, but depends on an undecidable quantity. And I guess if you just look at the ground state energy of your construction, you get kind of the same thing.
Right. So there is one important difference is I think that the tiling thing requires you to not put an upper bound on the number of tiles you have. Right? Or is it finite, the number of tiles?
That's right.
So because somehow
undecidable as
right.
Set of tiles.
I guess because as soon as you have like a finite number of possibilities, when you could just list all the possible inputs, in principle, right?
Yeah.
So this quantum phase estimation business, which is kind of a big complicated chunk of this, is just a weird way to kind of going around the problem by saying, I will fix the input dimension, and then I have to get a way to actually encode some arbitrary large input into these Hamiltonians. And the way it's done is by choosing like a rotation angle, a phase, with some rational steps. Otherwise, you could do a similar construction where you have this abundant dimension. But I guess that's kind of part of this whole machinery, which.
You have not made use of symmetries of the local Hamiltonian. For example, in the case of spin chain, spin half,
yes.
U1 symmetry or SU2 symmetry immediately tells you you have a Doppler situation. Even in IC quantum spin chain, if there is a duality, then at the dual point you have Doppler.
Right.
So when you go to higher dimension, is there any possibility of using the symmetries
to show that
to discuss issues like this?
Right. I'm not sure about the role of symmetry, but definitely this, as soon as you start adding assumptions, these things might become decidable. So you know, it's I'm not claiming that, and also this means there is no general way of deciding things, but of course you want to study Heisenberg interaction, that's obviously a different thing. So the fact that the general problem is not tractable, it doesn't mean that any specific kind of subset of a problem might be tractable, and usually what people are interested in about. So I'm not trying to dismiss all condensed matter as completely useless. I'm just trying to say, I also find very interesting somehow to think of this model as somehow, we always think of this condensed matter system as being defined by the local interactions. Here somehow we have one model for which the local interactions are well-defined, but it's not really clear what it means, the thermodynamic limit. It's not clear the connection now between the local and the large scale. So this is what my
but
if you add assumption, this thing might change completely and might not work. So and actually, even for frustration-free system, this is not clear how it would. We use a lot. I mean, for periodic boundary conditions, it's not clear. So yeah.
So along similar line, what about the reflection symmetry? So we were able to show that was still QMA-hard.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe there are some.
Probably it may be just the same trick, which is to break the symmetry.
Right, but somehow all these pieces have some dependence between them. But they're also sometimes you can switch one for the other if you're like careful about what you require. So if, I don't know if there are like maybe some symmetric computation models
Well, the,
where you like, you go and you go back.
I think the way we, I don't remember exactly, but the, basically the way we did it is adding another kind of layer that wants to do, like, it's just basically two states, and so it wants to do an alternating black-white, black-white. Mm-hmm. No, sorry, it was three states, it's ABC, ABC,
mm-hmm.
and that breaks the symmetry. But it may be still connected somehow, I don't know.
On the other hand, I think it's nice that a lot of variation of the Turing machines still are undecidable. Like if you have one-sided tape is still undecidable and all these things, so maybe it was just a way, but I haven't thought really about rotational symmetry.
Yeah.